You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The current design and function of the Internet have become so familiar that it's easy to forget that they grew out of programming decisions made fairly recently, decisions that influence the way we search the web, relate to others, and acquire information. Jaron Lanier, who has been described as the father of virtual reality technology, played a role in making some of those decisions. But today he's become a critic of the dehumanizing effects of technology, claiming that it hinders our creativity, relationships, and individuality. Jaron Lanier is a computer scientist, a composer, artist, musician, and the author of a new book from Knopf called You Are Not a Gadget. I am pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi.
And I'm so pleased to be here.
You begin your book with a very sobering preface, quoting, "It's early in the 21st century, and that means that these words will mostly be read by non-persons. The words will be minced into atomized search engine keywords within industrial cloud computing facilities. They will be copied millions of times by algorithms designed to send an advertisement. They will be scanned, rehashed, and misrepresented by crowds of quick and sloppy readers." That's not a nice way to describe your audience, Jaron.
The usual thing that one does is one flatters people to persuade them. The thing is that that's done so often that I think it really just, it's just become ridiculous. And I think I should be blunt and honest. And I think that embedded in that, I hope, is a sense of trust and respect, because it's not my intent simply to insult, but to be very, very clear, very laser-like, and I would only do that if I believed that somebody could receive that and deal with it honestly.
But recognizing that the way some of the public consumes books today has changed so much, you still decided to write and publish this anyway. Who do you want to reach? Young Facebook users, older computer users, novices, programmers?
Well, it's a strange moment. Right now, this hulking form of the paper book is the only means of communication where you can contain a set of thoughts that are as big as the ones I have to get across in a whole package that'll stay whole. If you do it in any other way, people will just read little bits and it'll be minced apart and remashed on the web and the way that things are. I'd like to have an alternative, but right now this is the best way to do it.
Have you seen the scenario we just read play out in the way your book is being received?
I've been stunned at how well it's been received. There's been some snarkiness online, of course, which I expected, but much less than I expected. I've actually been astonished.
Let's get into some of the things that you write about. Many of our listeners will recognize this thing. When Microsoft Word thinks you mean to spell a certain word or creates an indented outline for you, are these functions just trying to make our lives easier?
Well, okay. This stuff was done by a friend of mine, so shout out to Eric Horvitz. I am a part of the community I'm criticizing. I'm not talking about a distant other. These are not people over some ocean. These are my long-term friends and colleagues.
Is this book a mea culpa?
Oh, absolutely and explicitly so, without question. But getting back to the automatic outlining in Word, yeah, you're typing along and suddenly it says, oh, I know what this person wants, an outline. So why is that there? All of us know that what you actually have to do is you have to train yourself to learn how to avoid the outline thing or trigger it. So it's actually more work than just making an outline. So there's this other agenda, I think.
And what do you think it is? Like when this thing comes up and says, you are obviously writing a letter, do you need help?
And
no, I'm too stupid.
I should say also, I'm deliberately ratting on Microsoft because I'm actually working with them these days. So it's I prefer to rat on the people I'm working on than the competitors. I think it's
but Apple is
cleaner.
Just as culpable, isn't
Apple,
it?
Yeah, sure. Apple is. And honestly, Google's worse. But let's let's leave that aside. So there's been two competing ideologies, I think, in the history of computer science, information science. One I would call humanistic, and the other I would call a sort of a new religion in which people and machines are considered the same, and the goal of life is to create the biggest possible machine and live immortally within it. Now, that might sound like an exaggeration, but that's actually explicitly what a lot of people are talking about, some of the very most influential people. And so the idea of making the program pretend to understand you is part of this little ritualistic way of trying to start to think of the computer as if it's equivalent to you, as if it's alive, and to build that thought in and to blur the boundaries between the person and the machine.
Well, sometimes when we're using a search engine, we have barely typed four letters when it gives us all sorts of possible things that we're looking for. Again, making our lives easier, but also perhaps doing something annoying.
Well, see, whether a computer...
I mean, are they forcing us to go certain places on the internet, do you think?
I think what they force us to do is reconceive of ourselves. So the strange thing about the current internet is that there is this radical freedom where you can post anything, read anything, and yet the means by which you do it, the technique you use to do things, has embedded in it this model of what you are. And it makes you into less of an individual and more of a sort of a fragment, your source of anonymous little comments. Anything that's not anonymous might be grabbed and remashed by somebody else. So the way it affects you is not by forcing you to read certain things. It's not the problem that we have in China. The problem here is more changing how you think of yourself by forcing you to do things in a certain way.
Well, you mentioned things being free. A slogan often used in the movement you describe is information wants to be free. But you say some information doesn't deserve to be free.
Right. What I would say is that information doesn't even exist on its own. There's two kinds of information. One is a fundamental physical principle, which is related to something called entropy. And from a scientific point of view, we can talk about that and study it in the world of information science. But the kind of information that you can deal with computer programs, the stuff that we can interpret from computers, only exists to the degree that people can interpret it. Otherwise, it's just patterns in silicon that mean nothing. So to create the sense of life in this thing, you ultimately have to also demean yourself. There's no other way to do it.
My guest is Jaron Lanier, whose book is You Are Not a Gadget. It is published by Knopp. Well, we run into the whole problem of what should be free and what shouldn't. You mentioned China. And right now, Google, which has been criticized for a long time for allowing China to censor its service, now has said we're not going to allow that anymore. Isn't that commendable?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, this is a heroic moment for Google in the short term. In the long term, unfortunately, the alternative provided by Google isn't good enough either. And this is a problem. I mean, at the same time that Google is fighting for freedom of expression in China or taking a stand on it, which is absolutely commendable, it's also destroying the newspaper business back home. And the two things are somewhat related in the sense that both the Chinese Communist Party and Google want to be the sole channel to connect people together. They want to be the central node on the network, so to speak. China for the purpose of controlling what's said, and Google for the purpose of having a monopoly on advertisement. So there are important differences, but there's also a similarity.
But Google has always presented itself as an idealistic company, hasn't it?
And that's
don't
accurate.
Don't do harm, I mean, or what is their slogan?
Don't be evil. And that's absolutely authentic. I mean, once again, these are not distant people to me. These are people I've known for a long time, the specific individuals, and they're absolutely sincere. And there's no evil intent.
But they do seem to be taking over the world right now.
I think my interpretation of Google is it's more of a Shakespearean tragedy where evil overtakes us, despite our intentions, it's a great shame. But I do think that this plan of putting advertising at the core of civilization is actually an evil thing. Ultimately, not immediately, but if you follow how it'll play out, it doesn't go to good places.
So how did that transition occur from do no evil to the current situation?
Well, they're still not evil, but they're on the trajectory to become evil. They've caught the evil train. So the problem here is that advertising by being the central referral node of the internet is an incredible niche to have. It's an amazing commercial place to be. But it defunds all the stuff that's getting advertised. So ultimately, it eats itself. It's like a snake devouring its own tail. It's not sustainable.
you write, authors, journalists, musicians, and artists are encouraged to treat the fruits of their intellects and imaginations as fragments to be given without pay to the hive mind. Reciprocity takes the form of self-promotion. Are artists shortening their careers because they spend so much time engaged in all of this stuff? Social media, tweeting, blogging?
Well, the ideology, which I helped articulate and promote originally, so this is most definitely a mea culpa, is that even if we could no longer be paid for our content directly, we'd get so much free advertising or reputation as a result that surely a million other businesses would appear. And the reason that hasn't happened...
You mean we're making ourselves well-known? The alternative is you go... Let's say you're an artist. You go to galleries and you say, please give me a show. And the gallery says no. And you go to another gallery. And eventually you wind up without anybody knowing your work. You
right.
put it on the internet and everybody can get your work.
That's absolutely right. And that's a great thing. Now, if you go back to the origins of this stuff, there's a fellow named Ted Nelson who made up the idea of the web originally. And he called it hypertext. And the web is based on this thing called HTML. And the HT is hypertext, referring back to Ted's original concept. And his idea was that anybody could put up anything, but they could charge for it, and there'd be a universal micropayment system. So maybe you'd only charge a penny, whatever the market would bear. But you wouldn't remove intellectual and creative and emotional life from the economy, because when you remove that, but you still have to use real money to pay for rent and everything, then what you do is you do turn artists, you turn intellectuals into peasants. You do end up... You end up losing vitality. You end up with a degrading result. And I know that this is an unpopular thing to say, because the old ideology we made up took hold, and it's been repeated with such incredible gusto. But the thing to do is to follow the evidence. Like, if we really believe that there are all these new ways to make a living and this is benefiting, say, musicians, for just one class of affected party, go out and find these musicians who are doing so well. And that's what I've done. I've tried to look at it empirically, and the empirical results are just a disaster. And we've waited long enough. I mean, it's like decades now. We should be seeing some positive results, and we're not. So therefore, it's a failure. It's really empirical.
We're seeing newspapers go under, magazines go under. Mm-hmm. But we could also discuss the effect of these new technologies on creativity itself. The social environment of Web 2.0, in which everyone is constantly and openly communicating with large groups of people, it's not conducive to creating new original ideas, is it?
Well, this is another point I've made, which is controversial, but I think in order to be creative, you have to be able to have a moment of solitude. You have to have a moment where either you yourself or your team are separated from the world for just a bit, so you can get your ducks in a row and understand what you're doing before you present it. And so that's why scientists sometimes keep things confidential before they publish. It's a punctuated equilibrium in nature is exactly the same thing in the evolutionary process, where things are kind of churning around within the protected membrane of the cell, so all the genes don't just mix everywhere. You need that in order to have anything of substance build up to compete and compare against other things of substance. If everything's a huge global mush, things just kind of stay the same and average out.
I just read a study about multitasking, where students who do the most multitasking actually wind up getting the least out of their education. They think that they're getting more because they're drawing from so many different sources.
Yeah. I've seen that so many times in my own students, and it is an illusion. I've even seen it in myself, where I sort of think I've done more and understood more than I really have, because there are just all these bits flowing through.
This is like driving while talking on your cell phone and listening to the radio at the same time, and
right.
perhaps doing and having a conversation with the person in the car with you.
Well, And the flip side of pretending that people and machines are the same is pretending that quantity and quality are the same. So there's this notion that just if you have a lot of quantity on the web, it must get better automatically. But in fact, it's exactly the reverse is the truth, yeah.
My guest is Jaron Lanier, JaronLanier. His book, You Are Not a Gadget, A Manifesto, is published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Jaron Lanier, who's been called the father of virtual reality technology. He has worked on the interface between computer science and medicine, physics, and neuroscience. He also writes. In fact, we have a new book. And he composes. We just were listening to some of his music. His book, You Are Not a Gadget, A Manifesto, is published by Knopf. And since we were just listening to music, let's talk about the music industry. You use the music industry as a means of describing the negative effects of the free sharing of content.
Yeah, no, I'd like to explain why I care so much about this, because if we were really confident that the only disenfranchised groups were musicians and journalists, say, maybe we could deal with that. We could invent some new institution just to help the musicians and the journalists.
The world would adjust.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Technology is getting better and better and better. So someday, for instance, the musician who today can make some money selling a custom T-shirt, even if they give away their music for free, is not going to be able to do that, because incredibly cheap robots will be able to make custom T-shirts off of designs off the internet, just like you can burn a CD now, and the design of the T-shirt will become worthless. The person who can get a job as a nurse now is going to have their job challenged later on, maybe 20 years, 30 years, because home care robots are being developed like crazy in Japan because of their aging population. And I'm confident they're actually going to get really good. So the point is that just as Marx foresaw in the 19th century, as technology gets good, there is going to actually be this sort of shift where a lot of physical labor becomes less necessary, and either we come up with some regime where we're paying people for what they do with their brains, or we've really got to come up with some sort of socialism or some kind of other destination. So the fate of musicians is ultimately the fate of carpenters and the fate of everybody else. We really do have to watch this.
Well, we have a situation where Google and YouTube and a few others are making a lot of money, while the producers of content are getting nothing.
Yeah, well, this is the problem when you make advertising the only form of expression that's either worth anything or protected.
But in the case of YouTube, they also depend on the desire of so many people to have the 15 minutes of fame. So are they are providing some kind of a service, aren't they?
I think all those people who want a little bit of fame from their YouTube video would also appreciate some money. I don't think they'd turn it down.
On the other hand, isn't the internet a wonderful resource for discovering new music? There's such an amazing quantity of music available today for free online, and you can discover somebody or some kind of music that you might not have known about otherwise.
That's absolutely true, and I'm in no way denying that that's all true, but it's not as good as it could be, is the way I would put it. Right now, a lot of times people are listening to streams of music from some source, Rhapsody or Last or Pandora or whatever, and they don't even know who the people are. They don't. It's decontextualized. And also, a lot of music is mashed up, and a musician who puts out something that's popular can expect people to experience it as it's been mashed by many others. And in a sense, that does harm to individual expression. In just the way that some sort of censor or state bureaucrat could do harm. It's really not okay.
Apple provides you with music to put underneath something if you're producing a little piece. You don't even have to go to a composer. You can just simply pick up something that's lively or sad.
Yeah, but the people who make that music are paid, and they're actually paid pretty well. That's one of the sweeter gigs you can get in the business these days. So don't shed tears for those musicians.
Can I say that the main thesis of your book is the collective is not smarter or more creative than the individual?
You could say that, although see, if it weren't a slightly complex set of ideas, I wouldn't need a whole book to state them. So sometimes a collective is actually smarter. A collective is better at setting a price in a marketplace than a bureaucrat is, but the collective is worse at designing the product that you have to set a price for. So there's an important distinction there.
James Suriaki's book, The Wisdom of Crowds, among others, argued that that the crowd is also often wise. There's a famous experiment where a group of people are asked to guess the weight of something like a pig at a carnival, and the median guess of a few hundred guesses will often be surprisingly close to the real answer.
Right, and that's because a lot of people have a little bit of the truth, and if you average them out, you actually get something useful. That principle is absolutely real, and it's the reason why marketplaces can work at all, and it's also the reason why elections can work at all. Although these days in America, I wonder if I should even say that. But the point is that it doesn't work for everything. It only works if the output of the crowd is like a single number. It doesn't work for creating things. That's when we talk about design by committee, which is an insult, and it should be an insult.
Another factor in all of this is what you call the lock-in. What's that?
There's a problem with software that when a bunch of software gets tangled up with other software, it becomes so complicated to make changes that it just sort of stays put and gets stuck in place. And that has huge implications because it means that, for instance, if you design a communication system with certain models of what a person is, for instance, that anonymity is important or that individual expression should be turned into fragments and reused all the time, it's very hard to change that later on because it gets sort of baked in a way that's just really complicated to undo. So a lot of the ideas we have about ourselves and about life can sort of be attached to software that then becomes really hard to change. So what I'm concerned about is that our philosophy can kind of become immobilized and stuck in place for long periods of time.
Well, we have the QWERTY keyboard, don't we? They're having people come up with better keyboards, but we're kind of locked into the QWERTY.
Well, that's controversial, and
Do you like the Dvorak approach?
You know, I actually don't care about my keyboard too much.
We're so locked into the QWERTY.
It's very possible that style of lock-in of things like railroad gauges and QWERTY keyboards isn't really quite the same thing. That's an interesting
But the Dvorak does allow people to type 20% faster, I've heard.
So they say.
For me, it would be a godsend because I type so slowly.
Believe me, if you wanted to, you could collect a bunch of scholars on this question, and they would argue about keyboards. And if your listeners would find it interesting, they would be just vicious with each other, and you should go for it. But I personally don't really have a concern about
that. Well, you use the example of, is it called MIDI? M-I-D-I?
MIDI, M-I-D-I, yeah.
The language of digital music today.
Right, right.
How has that influenced the way that people compose music?
Well, this is an amazing story. A friend of mine named Dave Smith, who's a synthesizer designer out in California, just created the thing in his garage one day to tie some synthesizers together. And it's based on the way a keyboardist thinks. It has little digital signals for when the key goes up and when the key goes down. And it's become the universal way music is described. And if your phone sounds kind of beepy, that's because MIDI represents beeps really well. But MIDI can't represent speech. It can't represent what a violin can do or what a singer can do. It's this very... it's like tiles where it's just key up, key down, very, very mechanical. And so it's really had an influence on how music is made and how music sounds. And I think it'll be with us forever. In the book, I talk about
Well, isn't it just another musical instrument? You could choose to write on MIDI as opposed to piano or violin?
The problem with it, this is the thing. Lock-in happens because of interconnections. Of course you can avoid MIDI. The music of mine we were just hearing had nothing to do with MIDI, but you can't collaborate easily without MIDI. It's very hard to work into the system and work with other musicians and producers and available software and available tools unless you really buy into that. So of course you can, but for a lot of things, it's just so much work that you give in.
My guest is Jaron Lanier, who's written a book, a manifesto, he calls it, called You Are Not a Gadget. It's published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. As we discussed earlier, you were active in the group of programmers who designed many of the things we're discussing right now. Were you aware at the time that those decisions would turn out to be so influential?
Yeah, absolutely. We knew we were playing with fire. We absolutely knew that it was a historic moment, that we were in a unique position to create a little seed that would grow into a mighty oak. But I made a promise to myself back then, 25, 30 years ago, that I would always follow the data, and if it wasn't working, I'd be honest about it.
And if you could go back, are there things you could have done to have avoided some of the things that you think have turned out poorly?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest mistake was that we didn't follow Ted Nelson's original plan. Ted Nelson's original plan for the web, which dates back to the 60s. I mean, this thing has much more history than people realize.
But nobody was using the web.
The internet didn't exist yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was purely an abstract hypothetical concept. But if you go back to the original idea where you have genuinely universal micropayments, so something like the Apple iTunes store is just fine, but it's not enough. If it was genuinely universal and we could be selling music to people in China and vice versa, what a better world it would be. And that should have been baked in at a deep layer.
You also discuss the dangers of cloud computing. What's cloud computing?
Well, cloud computing is when you have vast computer resources that can be synchronized together using the internet. And I want to emphasize that I'm not anti-cloud computing.
But is that what Google works on?
Yeah, sure. Google has a cloud and Microsoft has a cloud and a few other companies do. And, of course, the intelligence services do. Cloud computing is an essential positive tool for mankind. We can't overcome global warming problems without cloud computing, for instance. Cloud computing is not only a good thing, but a vital thing as a technical resource. But what I'm concerned about is the religion that's trying to pretend the cloud is coming alive. And if we relate to the cloud that way, then we do really screw ourselves over.
But don't you also say that cloud computing may be partially responsible for the financial meltdown that we're experiencing?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at how the financial meltdown happened, it happened because financiers doing the same kinds of tricks that had led to previous financial scandals were able to amplify those tricks within the cloud. And so the hedge fund computers, if you visited some of these hedge funds, it was remarkably like visiting the Googleplex. Basically, what you had was these vast amounts of information flowing into these machines. Then you're doing a search engine, very much Google might search for pizza. These places were searching for money.
The statistical reasoning is that this cloud computing takes the risk out of making bets, doesn't it?
Well, the hypothesis, which is incorrect, is that if you get all this information and you can do this wonderful statistical analysis in the cloud, you take the risk out of profit making, and then just you have ultra entitlement. You have infinite entitlement because you own the cloud, you have no risk, and you just sort of pull money out. Now, of course, that's false for many reasons, including that there actually isn't enough information and that the algorithms actually aren't that good, and a whole bunch of things. But that was the delusion. And the hedge funds and what Google's doing with advertising are mirror images of each other.
You also write a lot about the social effects of sites like Facebook. Some young people will boast about the number of friends they have on the site, but haven't they devalued friendship in the process?
Yeah, see, this is the problem. Whenever you think that a computer representation of you is legit, if you believe that the computer really understands when you want to make that indentation in your word processing, if you believe the search engine really understands you, if you believe that Facebook can really recommend a friend because it really gets you, on some level you have to reconceive yourself downward. You have to lessen yourself. You have to make yourself stupid to make the machine smart. And that's the danger. And it happens gradually. And I think it makes us blander. And I think it's doing damage.
Well, I can boast of having thousands of friends because that's how many people are my friends on my Facebook page. I'm so unsophisticated about those things. I've gone through them. I don't recognize most of those people.
Yeah, well, I've avoided Facebook myself because I think it would really it just wouldn't work for me. But my cat has been an avid Facebook user and has really educated me a lot about the experience. And my cat has thousands of friends as well.
Well, you argue that computers have changed, perhaps ruined the meaning of friendship as teaching to the test has changed education.
Yeah, teaching to the test under the No Child Left Behind Act is the mirror image of Facebook. It's the idea that you take a computer representation of what's going on in people's brains and hearts and treat it as if it's real and then let it become the source, the causal element in what happens next. And it's exactly the same thing, same problem.
And you write that the real customer in these social networks is not the teen with a profile, but the advertiser.
Right. And here's the great irony that companies like Facebook and Twitter are started in the hopes of creating great empires, but there's unfortunately a lock-in monopoly effect to the Google advertising exchange that already exists. So therefore, these new things can't really make money. So they change society. They change the experience of being a teenager. In some ways, I will admit, a little bit for the better, but there are also all these other problems. And they don't even make money. Like, if it was really market-driven, they'd be out of business. It's all based on this faith. Like this, it's such a strong feeling in Silicon Valley that we have to make the net come alive, that there's money for this kind of stuff, even if it doesn't make a good business.
Is that why a Beacon on Facebook was such a disaster?
Well, now, Beacon goes back a couple of years, and Beacon was a case where Facebook kind of made it too clear that they were violating privacy. And now they're, the current situation is a really interesting one. The privacy setting on Facebook is so complex that if you're geeky, you can control it and you feel totally empowered. But if you're not geeky, you really can't. So it gives it favors geeks. It gives geeks dignity and removes a bit of dignity from everybody who can't keep up.
Kathy in New York City left a comment on her show page. She asks, how do you explain the success of open source development of software with regards to your negative take on the wisdom of crowds?
Well, very simply, I think open source has successfully created copies of things rather than original things. And I have a long story in the book about the origins of the open source movement, because it has a very specific origin with a guy named Richard Stallman, who used to be a friend of mine. And this argument actually goes back to that origin point, where in order to make the open source thing work, you make copies of things like Unix, such as Linux, but you have to give up another kind of idealism, which is making really radical new stuff. And the radical new stuff, and I'll use the iPhone as an example, has to come out of shops that close themselves off in order to really understand what they're doing, rather than being fudged into the giant global mush. You have to be able to separate a little bit in order to be original.
You recommend a more humanistic approach to organizing the web and the relationship that we have online. How do you see that happening? What would you do to change the way people conduct themselves online?
Well, I think anonymity should really be reserved for when somebody's in danger. I think it's crucial to keep a role for dissidents in situations where they could be in danger, or whistleblowers in situations where they could be in danger. But it's important through a combination of just social convention and perhaps some technical implementation to try to decrease the use of anonymity in cases where people aren't in danger, because it really brings out the worst. And I think it's also crucial to try to avoid the way the internet is structured right now. People clump together into like-minded groups, and then see, I think deep inside the human soul or inside our biology evolved a switch that can change us from individuals to pack animals. And when we join the pack, we really get mean, and I'm really concerned about turning the switch with some of the designs that we have online now. And you can see it all the time in the way that people get mean online.
You've been called the father of virtual reality technology. Is that still okay with you?
I've never called myself that. I did work awfully hard on virtual reality and continue to.
Mm-hmm. And is that at least developing to your satisfaction?
Yeah, virtual reality has been a great success on many levels. It's improved surgery a great deal. It's improved the ability of pilots to pilot vehicles and for us to design vehicles for them. It's really been a tremendous success industrially. And it's as far as the consumer fun thing that everybody wants, or not the consumer, I shouldn't use that word, but the fun cultural event, it's kind of creeping up on us. Things like the Avatar movie and the release of Natal coming up, those things are sort of getting us incrementally closer to it.
Jaron Lanier's book, You Are Not a Gadget, A Manifesto, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
I'm so delighted to be here.